I think the dehumanization of the Black person is what made it so easy for atrocities to happen. You can draw that straight line from slavery, colonialism, to what the challenges that people of African descent continue to face globally.
There's a lot of power in naming things for what they are. In the South African context, we are still in the majority, but are still the poorest. And that is a direct result of colonialism and apartheid.
You yourself weren't beaten. I wasn't beaten. I wasn't raped. I wasn't. But I see a story or hear a story or read a book about people as if I am. Because I know that if I were there, it could easily be me.
Just because I'm free, what does that mean?
Welcome to The Making of Atrocities. Is Racism a Risk Factor? A podcast from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience and the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation. This series addresses racism as a risk factor for atrocity crimes on a global scale and within the framework of racial justice and anti-racism. Each episode explores different manifestations of racism, from the racialized capitalism of colonialism and slavery to contemporary racial injustices in policing, media, and the economy. Our expert guests help expose how these manifestations increase the risk of atrocity crime and affect the lives of people of color today. My name is Purusha Naidu, and I am a program manager at the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, and I am your host for this episode. I am delighted today to be joined in conversation with Gaynel Curry and Luvano Ntuli, both work at the interface of addressing the causes and consequences of structural inequalities that are rooted in both historical and contemporary injustices. Thank you both for joining me today. To frame our conversation, I would like to ask both of you how you came to your respective fields of work and how your environments, country, family, community have all influenced you in the way that you now work. So Gaynel, beginning with you as a human rights expert who has worked across the United Nations in various countries and roles with committed focus on issues of gender and race, and now serving as an independent expert member of the UN Permanent Forum of People of African Descent. Please tell us about your journey.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I have been very fortunate to come from a line of very strong Black women who were all about justice and freedom and equality. So I come from a passionate line of women who believe in education, who believe in justice, who believe in rights, who believe that girls are equal to boys in terms of opportunity. And so I had that sort of in my blood somehow, the fight. And so I studied history, political science, law, human rights, really interested again in justice, equality, and social justice issues, really, what it means to have a voice, participate in your own country. That led me into the UN. I entered the UN as a competitive exam candidate and worked initially with the treaty body, starting with the rights of the child. So I've worked at almost every single UN human rights treaty body. I supported expert members looking at what states are doing to fulfill their obligations and meet international human rights standards. And so I got that very broad background. And having worked closely with experts, it was almost a natural move for me to become an expert myself. I was asked by my government if I would be willing to consider joining the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent. And so I was happy to put myself forward. Fortunate for me, I was selected as one of the members. 10 members are on the Permanent Forum African descent. We're happy to be there and happy to have had this journey leading to this point where I can speak on a global stage in support of people of African descent, their rights, the opportunities for them, just to say that they belong, their voices are important.
So Luvano, turning over to you as an activist and practitioner with a keen focus on economic crimes, transitional justice, and social restitution, and your current work at South African-based NGO Open Secrets, which utilizes investigative research, litigation, and advocacy to expose the power and profit of state and private corruption and exploitation. Please tell us about how you came to this work.
Thanks, Harusha, and hello, everyone. It's actually interesting. So I'm currently reading for my master's in justice and transformation, which has a very specific focus on transitional justice and its different implementations across different contexts. And so I grew up with this love and passion for justice, but not really knowing where to place it and where to locate it. My father was very active during the anti-apartheid movement, particularly in his varsity years and high school years. He grew up in rural Eastern Cape and during apartheid. So I think he was very much influenced by that. My mother in the township in South Africa, in Soweto. And so I think coming from that background of two parents who were significantly marginalized during apartheid and kind of their struggles and their keen focus on justice. But I think ultimately their desire for me and for my younger brothers to have access to opportunities informed a lot of things, even though I was not necessarily engaging with it actively until I got to high school and was learning about our history as South Africans. This is really something I'm passionate about. And so a lot of my interest was initially around land dispossession and tracing settler colonial expansion within South Africa and locating that within apartheid. And it expanded to a broader idea of what does socioeconomic harm look like in our context. And not just that, but structural harm. And so a lot of my focus now is around gender and LGBTQI rights and what that means within the framework of transitional justice, where it's failed and potentials that it has to be more transformative, what reparative justice could look like and mean. And I'm reading and writing a lot around gender-based violence, particularly sexual violence, and just the lack of politicization around that historically and both in contemporary South Africa. And then through my work, it's a very different kind of focus on justice and that it looks at particularly economic crime, which I didn't think I would get into as in depth as I have, but it's been such an exciting journey because I get to really understand what complex financial crime looks like and also what that has meant historically and in contemporary South Africa. And as we discuss corruption and structural harm, I think it's really interesting to look at what that means within our history and what that means going forward.
Thank you, Levano. I think it's interesting to think about how both the journeys of you and Gaynal speak to families trying to navigate structures and obstacles and finding ways to really put forward and progress both you as individuals, but your lineages and your communities. So within that framing, I think I'd like to get into the feminine forum with Gaynal and specifically to ask you how the mission of the permanent forum focuses on racism and discrimination and inequality and how it makes sense of that within the work that it does. And more specifically, what are the ways that this permanent forum is distinguished and different to other initiatives by the UN to speak about racism and discrimination and inequality?
The permanent forum really is looking at the human rights, lives, and livelihoods of people of African descent. So we're looking at it in terms of historically what happened to people of African descent and currently what we're facing in terms of discrimination and also the future, what to be happening in the future. We have several means by which we're doing it according to our mandate. So the mandate talks about the forum looking at the Durban Declaration of 2001. The Durban Declaration and Program of Action really was the first time, I think, the international community made that link between slavery, colonialism, currently inequalities, discrimination, racism that people of African descent face. We're supposed to be looking at how we can promote the Program of Action from Durban. But that's the first one. And I like to sort of look at the four Ds. Durban is how I remember it, right? And then we're looking at the declaration, the fact that at this point in our lives or in this history of people, we ought to be thinking about a declaration prepared by people of African descent for people of African descent. What are we saying we want? And then, of course, we have the decade, and we're in the final year of the decade for people of African descent. And so for us, we're asking the question, what has happened in this decade? Not very much, regrettably, very much. And we would have wanted to see the international community embrace it more holistically And I said that even of my region, for us, we have pushed on the issue of reparations since 2014 with the CARICOM 10-point plan. But in terms of the decade, what we wanted to see come out of that did not come across very clearly in the region. And certainly at the national level, most states have done very little with anything. As a result, the Permanent Forum is asking for a second decade. We're saying we need a chance to do this again. And hey, we had 400 years of slavery. Why can't we have two decades to promote the rights of people of descent? Right? It's a small thing. And this time we're saying it should be funded. There should be political will and commitment to the implementation of programs that advance, improve the rights and lives and livelihoods of people of African descent. And finally, the final D word for the forum is with that. What we have found in our short time working, the last 2 years of working as forum, is that Black people are often invisible, particularly in global statistics. So there's reference to groups within that framework, Indigenous and others, and we support that. We think that's important that they're there. Yeah. But there's not a mention anywhere of people of African descent. And when you don't mention us, we become invisible. So you talk about progress and they may be progressing. Just the country as a whole. But Black people are not. So for us, that final D is data. And I know that some states are resistant to collecting data based on race, but we're saying if we're not counted, you will not develop policies that include us. The platform, I think we're the only mechanism that looking at anti-racism, the promotion of Black people or people of African descent, none of these mechanisms provide a platform where people of African descent themselves can come and bring their culture, their voices, their experiences, and speak on the stage. This is what we provide. We're starting to encourage Black people to come forward, to show themselves in all their glory, beauty, grace, intelligence, and all of it, right? Artistic abilities at our forum. And so we've had our first meeting, we had like 300 plus. In New York, when we met last year, the second meeting, we had well over 1,000 people in the room. That was awesome. To be in a room with 1,000 Black people was like so empowering for me personally. Have that broad convening panel where we see masses of Black people coming together to really share their experience and promote, discuss themselves, participate in how they see this going, how they see the communities rising, and to work for what we call justice. And hopefully reparations in the future moving forward.
Thanks again, Alia. And I really think that speaks to the sort of democratizing power of bringing the UN to the people, actually, through the Permanent Forum. That's very inspiring. Lovano, I'd like to turn over to you to think about how you locate both your work, which you've spoken about, as well as the work of Open Secrets in relation to the ongoing legacy of both colonialism and apartheid in South Africa. And then how we think through that within the current reality of extensive state corruption, structural inequalities, and a democratic transition that many people in our years at university were calling into question in terms of the lack of material changes for countless Black people in South Africa. So where do you locate your work within that?
So I think that there's a very interesting line of argument that Open Secrets follows, and that's around this long shadow of economic crime within South Africa. And I think it speaks very directly to the fact that corruption and economic harm, economic injustice are not a product of the current ANC government, but rather something that we can locate from the beginning of the settler colonial project, right? The codification of inequality and structural harm through apartheid laws and through the ways in which private networks were able to uphold and benefit from the apartheid, the colonial apartheid regime. And what the codification of this inequality looks like is really that entrenching of networks of power that are left unaddressed. And when we reflect on during apartheid, it's the lack of legal and political power that Black people had to maybe call these things out. I think there was a large focus on civic and political, and this is what we also locate within the democratic transition, is this focus on the civic and legal and political kind of aspect of what harm looks like, the denial of rights and freedom of movement and those kinds of things, the right to vote. But I think what the apartheid regime really was able to entrench was that economic power, which was held within the hands of the white elite and how that has that system had maintained itself and was not uprooted during the democratic transition. And so what I think we can see now is that the lack of disruption in those networks just becomes remodeled and re-entrenched. And even though it takes on this new face with the Black government, that is not necessarily the truth or the case of what happened in South Africa. We have to locate corruption now with the lack of the disruption of power and those networks within the apartheid regime. And I think that, for instance, when we look at the role that big businesses played, I think when the TRC or the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was dealing with these different injustices and politically motivated crimes, I think that while there was a recognition that big business did benefit, they were able to get away with it because there was this lack of political will or this lack of attempt to want to address big. And so I think what we see during the apartheid regime is especially European banks such as Credit Bank and KBL in Luxembourg, and the way that they were able to bankroll the National Party and the way that they facilitated the flow of money from the apartheid regime, which was then able to buy arms, which was then able to wage war against Black people. That is what business did. When we talk about structural harm, when we talk about economic harm within the context of apartheid, that's what we're really looking at. It's not just about the amassing of wealth. It's also about how wealth is used as a weapon. And so I think that a lot of Open Secrets' work is trying to locate that connection. So when we look at corruption now in South Africa, it is very much about how power is within the hands of the elite and how Black people are still being disproportionately disadvantaged, despite the fact that they have legal rights now. I think that codification of structural inequality has just reproduced itself. And I think that we can't necessarily paint corruption now in this new light. There is a shadow behind it. And that is that of apartheid and colonial economic harm.
Thank you, Davanyo. So within the framing of how you've both fought through the work that you do, I would like to hear how you see the links then more explicitly between racism and structural inequalities and then atrocities, given that's the larger focus of this podcast series. How are structural inequalities mapped directly onto historically marginalized groups? And how can these inequalities leave groups vulnerable to experiencing further harms or atrocities? Okay, now we can begin with you and then turn over to Lovano.
I think the dehumanization of the Black person is what made it so easy for atrocities to happen. Even today, I think that when you have police officers and others speaking to Black young men, it's almost as if they continue to be dehumanized. They're not real human beings in the way they are treated and the way they're spoken to, the way they're spoken about. I have to add this, even in the UN, I was in the UN for 20 odd years, and the type of comments I would hear my colleagues saying would cause me to cringe and in many cases bring tears to my eyes. They speak of Black people in a very derogatory manner. They speak of Black people as animals, as apes, as they're lowering the standards of the UN by hiring Black people. And the Secretary General himself said that you can draw that straight line from slavery, colonialism, to what inequalities, the underdeveloped inequality that Black people face, the underdevelopment that Black countries face, the challenges that people of African descent continue to face globally. And so the atrocities that we face, not only attacks on the Black body, which happens and happened since slavery, right? And women who are a lot of that. The mixtures that we see in this society had a lot to do with how our bodies were abused. And we were the only ones to bring forth slaves, right? As women. And knowing that when you produce this human being, this you're bringing them into a condition that you yourself do not want to be in. And matters made worse because many of them were raped to provide labor and economic wealth for the whites. So this whole psychology, the trauma, I think, of slavery and colonialism and the perpetuation of these perceptions of Black people continues to traumatize, or we haven't resolved that among ourselves. And it sometimes comes out in the family violence that we see and so forth. And people ask me, how can it go back so far? I don't know if we ever really dealt with the trauma of being dehumanized in such a way and what that has meant to people as individuals, right? You yourself weren't beaten. I wasn't beaten. I wasn't raped. I wasn't. But I see a story or hear a story or read a book about people as if I am, because I know that if I were there, it could easily be me. They had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, and I don't know how helpful that was. I think it, to me, in my mind, to actually have a chance to speak about what happened is a positive thing. To pretend as if nothing happened and all of a sudden you're free and let's all pretend like there was no slavery and let's move along and you don't speak about it, you don't. Why are you taking us back there? Why do you want to talk about it? So it makes it so easy when you don't humanize people, when you keep it silent, when you don't speak about what actually happened to Black people, when you don't give them a chance to trace their lineage. I can't say where I come from. I just know that my ancestors were a number in a book somewhere. We didn't sit back and take it. We rebelled. There were all over the Caribbean people trying to stand up, but would put down with such brute force. And when I think about this, I think about the atrocities of Haiti, where they did succeed. They rebelled and they succeeded, but they were punished, not only made to pay reparations to France and to pay high loans in terms of interest rates to the U.S. to be able to meet those obligations, but the punishment that they received as Black people, in my mind, has haunted that country even until today, where they're still grappling with what does it mean to be free? What does it mean to understand redress? They know what it means for reparations because they had to pay it. But what does it mean for them to receive it? For them to take the wealth that they generate, to put it into their own country, to develop their schools, their hospitals, their roads, their factories, what for them? And that has not happened. And that's the biggest example of the type of atrocity that I could see linked to slavery, colonialism, and where we are today. In lesser cases, it happened to other countries, but blatantly, you see it in Haiti. And the atrocities can never be overcome until we face them head on. We look about redress and we talk about reparations. And we mean it as an international community. We commit to it.
Okay, now I think you spoke on so many things that I was like, brilliant, like exactly. And I think, like you said, there's a lot of power in naming things for what they are, right? So I think what we struggle with in the South African context is that even though there is very clear evidence of those structural inequalities. So, for example, during the colonial apartheid era, Black people were relegated to the margins of the country, even stripped of citizenship of South Africa, and they had to be basically bused and trained in whatever the case is to work in the white settler polity and then be taken back out at a whim. Those inequalities still exist. They're very visible. But now, because you don't have to have a card that authorizes your existence within the white polity, your claim or ownership over that space, you shouldn't even have that kind of contention. You can access the space. What's the problem? But it's like that mentality and that kind of not being able to be like, this is what apartheid structural planning looks like, spatial planning looks like. And it is linked way back to colonialism. And so I think that there is that power in naming things as they are. I think with the TRC, had both, there were both benefits and there were disadvantages and advantages to it. I think, like you said, again, now the power of testimony is powerful. I think it's important. I think being able to tell the truth of what happened is important. But I think the difficulty with that is that there was a very specific time frame that the TRC could deal with. It was 1960 to 1994. That was not the beginning of apartheid. That was not the beginning of colonialism. So now when you're trying to locate issues around sexual violence, which happened from the arrival of the colonizer, land dispossession, which are those sorts of things, aren't captured from 1960. Those were already deeply entrenched. And I think the issue with accountability then, being able to name something for what it is, there is no acknowledgement. So what does that mean for repair? You need to be able to say, this is what happened in order to repair it. With reparations, for instance, I think that it's difficult to think through what reparations would look like when you're dealing with centuries of oppression and harm. And I think the difficulty with the settler colony especially is that in the case of South Africa, which is different to other settler colonies in the sense that the majority of Indigenous people were not eradicated. They are still in the majority, yet they still own the least amount of land. They still have access to the least amount of space, those sorts of structures. That's what structural inequality really means to me, and how we can link it to the colonial project, the apartheid project, is the fact that we are still in the majority, but are still the poorest. And that is a direct result of colonialism and apartheid. And as much as there's an acknowledgement of the fact that apartheid did all these things, the settler colonial denialism aspect of our history, I think, is what really is going to continue to entrench inequality. That attempt to address these colonial institutions that are still inherently colonial, the falling of a statue doesn't change the fact that the structure of the institution was carved out of a mountain and out of the land on which Indigenous people had existed and were then removed from. And we now, as Black people, are forced to exist in this space. I think the decolonizing project in South Africa is also difficult to engage with because the settler colonial project, it's alive and thriving and kicking. And so even though there's now an attempt to deal with it in the TRC, it still isn't enough. It isn't adequate. And so that's why I think there's an erosion of trust between mechanisms of accountability and the people who justice is being done for. There is no sense of trust. There's no sense of holding the space. There is none of that because ultimately the conditions still exist. Just like Gena, like you said, just because I'm free, what does that mean?
So Devana, you brought up reparations. So I'm going to stick with you for a moment and then turn over to Gaynal. So how do you make sense of South Africa's, in many ways, failed reparations agenda? We can think of countless victims of apartheid that were identified to receive reparations that received, I think, a once-off payment of 2,000 rand. There's a president's fund for reparations that we hope is still intact. And then countless other widespread inequalities when it comes to basic needs being met. Can you tell us about Open Secrets' work around thinking about reparations in South Africa? And then the truth-seeking work that has happened around economic crimes, specifically the People's Tribunal on Economic Crimes, that was organized by citizens to submit evidence of state failures.
Like you said, the reparations process and program was, it was thought of in a particular way, but the execution was completely different. So the way the TRC had envisioned was several payments over the course of 6 years to deal with the material injustice or material inequality. And then there were also attempts at community reparations in a way to engage with symbolic reparations. So those different things of naming, the naming of streets, the naming of places. So there's a whole different kind of what reparations mean, and that's within the framework of reparative justice. And so when the Mbeki administration takes over in 2003, they change that. So there is a renaming of places and spaces, but the payments then were not over 6 years. Like you said, Parisha, the once-off payment, $2,000, which at the time was around 30,000 rand. And the number of victims also was really contentious because not many people could access the TRC to testify, to apply for, to qualify for reparations, right? I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's within the tens of thousands of victims that were identified as opposed to the millions of South Africans that were actually affected, Black South Africans that were affected. And so the Mbeki administration's approach was that because all Black South Africans were affected by apartheid, there should be a broader scale development agenda to deal with those inequalities. But the problem with naming it development and not naming it reparation is that you change the fundamental purpose of what it's for. Development goes along with the global political agenda at the time, and incorporating South Africa into countries that were already independent of colonialism and also the West and whatever the case is. So I think that now in naming it development, you take away the fact that it's supposed to answer for apartheid era crimes. It's not part of a broader global project. I think that was one of the issues with reparations. And I think Open Secrets has a very clear kind of understanding around the importance of what reparations will mean for an ongoing engagement with reparations. The President's Fund does still exist, but there's a lot of issues around accessing it, the transparency around it, how much is available within the fund and what has and hasn't been paid out of that. And there are a number of civil society organizations in South Africa trying to engage with that issue currently. And the reparations program stems from the TRC, which is a truth-telling and accountability-seeking body. And I think that there's a lot of power in having victims come and give testimony. And so in the open secret context of thinking through something like a truth-telling body, the People's Tribunal is a really great example. I think that it's a way that the organization was able to partner with different civil society organizations to address the South Africa's current state of corruption, but also linking it to the apartheid project. And very directly speaking back to what the TRC, I guess, failed to do in addressing economic crime and economic harm. And so the People's Tribunal was really around engaging with issues of corruption and state capture. And so the tribunal heard evidence from various different witnesses and put together a charter with findings around what corruption has meant, especially for the everyday South Africans. I think when we look at the breakdown of some of our really important SOEs, our passenger rail system, those different kinds of bodies, and linking that not just to state looting, but how private interests were fundamental in that. It's not just the state that was dealing from these SOEs. There were actually a multitude of different banks and auditors and lawyers and all those things that enabled and were able to uphold that system. And so the People's Tribunal kind of really paved the way for those investigations at Open Secret to take place.
Thank you, Navano. So Ginal, turning back to you on the question of development. So I know that you have been involved in work around sustainable development goals. And we were lucky enough to meet in person with you in December in Brazil and Rio as part of this project in thinking through atrocity crimes and racism as a risk factor. And something you said resonated, and I wanted to hear more of your thoughts on it. You said that essentially sustainable development not include a reparations agenda. We need to think about reparations if you want to talk about something like sustainable development. Can you tell me a bit more what you meant by that? And as a second part to that question, in some ways, reparations agenda is alive and part of a long lineage, but in other ways, it's cast aside and ignored or tiptoed around. Within that framing, how do you make sense of sustainable development and the reparations agenda and where they meet and where they perhaps don't meet? And what more needs to be done to put it at the center of our conversation?
Working with the Sustainable Development Goals or the 2030 Agenda, it does not include people of African descent as a group that needs to be prioritized. So right at the onset, it says to me that this framework does not want to be about, you know, doesn't even want to think about the past, doesn't even want to think about how did we get to a state of underdevelopment. So it's saying, well, let's not look at that. Let's look at where we are right now and how we can move forward. But I'm one of those persons, perhaps I'm really a historian at heart. I feel that you have to explore what happened and where you've come from to understand where it is you want to go, to ensure that you don't keep making the same mistakes, and to ensure that you bring about real change for the persons who are in need of change, which is really those who are on the periphery of development, so to speak. Because that particular agenda has already freezed out and left it at the discretion of states themselves to determine if and how and why they're going to bring in Black people and include them, it says to me that fundamentally that framework is weak in a sense for Black people. It doesn't meet what we needed to meet. It does not encourage states to or even hold them accountable for the obligations that they have under international law. They've signed on, most of them, to these international human rights treaties, and then there's an obligation to address inequalities and discrimination. That's a big part of what human rights is about, right? It's about non-discrimination, but we already have a platform, a framework that starts at the very outset by excluding or making certain people invisible. So we need to rethink the whole 2030 agenda. I think that no state is really on track for it. But more importantly, no state will be on track in terms of how it addressed issues of discrimination against Black people. And I say this also for Caribbean communities, because the Caribbean, we tend not to think about race all the time, Caribbean, because we are predominantly Black countries. And although we still have some colonies. Britain has colonies, France has colonies, and the Netherlands has colonies still in the Caribbean. So the issue of decolonization continues, right? I mean, we are in a situation where as Black, majority Black countries, we tend not to want to speak about race anymore. But we look at issues of inequality and who is going to be always at the bottom of the development agenda is Black people, poor Black people, particularly Black women. They tend to be at the very bottom of all of this discussion around it. So Caribbean countries need to be forced to think about, well, forced is not the right word, need to be encouraged to think more strategically about the issue of race and what it actually means within their own countries. Now, we've done a lot of discussion around reparations because since we, as it became of the CARICOM 10-point plan for reparations in 2014, and it took some many years for that to be discussed within CARICOM for us to come to that agreement. What I like about the 10-point plan is it really looks at issues around development. So it speaks of issues of education and health and so forth and the realities of Black people in that region and what needs to. Others have also more recently started sort of talking about, it's one of those issues, I've been in the international arena for quite a while, one of those issues that is now gaining traction. In 2019, the Europeans spoke about it in the parliament. In 2022, the African Commission spoke about it again. The Secretary General is now speaking about it. The High Commissioner is now speaking about it. We've had special rapporteurs speaking about it. We have one on reparations, in fact, a special rapporteur on reparations. And so, it's becoming something that is a part of our discourse, right? And what stopped us from doing it before, I think that I always say the train has left the station on this, the horse has run out the barn. We have to just try and figure out how they're going to manage it, because I think it's not if, it's when. It's not if, it's how reparations are going to be a reality for Black people and for what we call the transatlantic enslavement of Black people. Right. And so the kidnapping, the enslavement, the voyage, the treatment that continues on to date, all of that has to be addressed. We've not addressed it. Any part of this world, we haven't adequately addressed it. When I say this world, I mean the Americas. There are a lot of them, right? A lot of Blacks came from Africa to us. And I'm going all the way down to Brazil as well. I was there last year, as we said, and seeing the reality of what happened there. But what has stopped states is, of course, that political will. And they put forward lots of arguments. Oh, it's been too long. We don't have a perpetrator, clear perpetrator, clear victim. And we can't quantify it, this and that. Well, I think those are excuses. The Brathel Group has just issued a report in 2023 quantifying what is owed to states in the Caribbean. And we had Justice Robinson from Jamaica, who was on ICJ for many years, as one of the main persons engaged in that whole discussion about how do we quantify this. We're getting now down to issues that they don't want to talk about. The former slave masters do not want to talk about. And they say, no, we can't quantify it. Everybody's dead who was involved. You don't have a perpetrator and a victim and so forth. But there's certain crimes that are timeless. There's no time, no statute of limitation on crimes of genocide, on victims of crimes against humanity, and those ought not to be. And those individuals were not necessarily acting as individuals. They were acting as representatives of the state. Many came with the blessings, the money, and the ships and so forth of the state. Certainly with colonialism, we can say that. So it's not the individual necessarily we're speaking. We're speaking about the state and the state responsibility there. And what ought to happen. And I would encourage us to think, to have a look at that Brathel report to see how they've quantified. I think it's very well done because we're getting closer to the fact. We're not talking about individuals getting something. We're talking about what are you going to do to ensure that you contribute to the real development? Because we've been talking about development before our birth, development of Africa, of Latin America. And really, we can still see that this inequality and real development has not taken place because large percentages of the population remain in precarious situations, remain on the margins of society, remain poor, which is one of our biggest challenges in the region. We have countries that are middle-income countries and doing very well, including my own country, the Bahamas. We're doing relatively well, but there are significant pockets of poverty And these are Black people in what we call the Over the Hill communities, right? Which is where we were allowed to go. We had something similar to segregation and apartheid. So we can come to the waterfront to work for the whites, which is where they live. But we had to go back over the hill before dark. And that's where we lived. And so four black people in those Over the Hill communities continue to be the hub, epicenter of all the poverty, and where you have significant incidents of crime, instability, widespread health and housing challenges, you know. So there's still a lot of work to be done. We have to think about, again, about how we ensure that whenever we get out of reparations, because as I said earlier, we will get something that goes into the real development of the people, the very poorest Black people whose parents, grandparents, great-grandparents were the ones who were scrubbing floors, cutting cane, doing whatever they needed to do for the master. So at the end of the day, until we have, we must link reparations to development.
As a final question, I'd like to ask both of you, where are the spaces, people, and movements where you're observing strategic and hopeful partnerships to creating just and equitable futures that are free of atrocities and racial discrimination?
The spaces that seem, if I may use the word, ripe in my mind for this is educational spaces, is universities. As I'm teaching, I teach law, public international law, human rights, and government and politics. And so what amazes me is the lack of knowledge of our history, right? You cannot really study constitutions and constitutionalism and where our constitutions come from and that kind of thing. If I ask an example, who is Marcus Garvey and what is Pan-Africanism? It's like a blank stare. And so we have not been adequately teaching our own history. We are at fault of that. I will tell you, my first 2 degrees are history and history. And I did not study anything about the great African civilizations at all until the master's level. So all through high school, there's no mention of Africa in any of my books. In my geography book, that's Africa. And then the triangular slave trade. But learning about Africa, we never did. It's simply, we never did. And I mentioned about not having a name back in the day during slavery. Apart from ripping off of our name, they ripped up as our languages. We had nothing of Africa other than the color of our skin. I did history and I could name all the kings of Europe and all the stuff, but I couldn't tell you anything about Africa, which is sad. Right? So we have to begin to teach in our own history, tell our own stories in our own words. We have to write about our histories, write about our stories, and not have our children only read what Europeans have to say about us. And we have to make a greater connection between Africa and the diaspora, Blacks in diaspora. I will say in recent years, there's been a greater effort. But I don't know anyone in my country who was saying, oh, let me go to study. I want to study human rights. Let me go to University of Pretoria, which has a very good human rights institute, right? They're not saying, because that never even occurs to them. They don't know about it. There's no one pushing. But the first time in December 2023, we had our first embassy discussion. So we didn't even have embassies. We've been independent for 50 years. We didn't even, beyond our meetings at the UN and so forth, and Commonwealth Secretariat and so forth, many of us did not have diplomatic relations. And so why aren't we having more diplomatic relations with Africa? With African countries, with the African Union, generally speaking? How are we engaging? Those are kinds of spaces. So educational spaces. Why aren't we reading books? I think we did read Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart when I was in high school. Apart from that, I knew no other African writers. And you have many excellent writers. And so I see opportunities for us to engage by bringing that to our curriculum, by you learning about us. And it was a very deliberate effort of slavery and colonialism not to teach us about Africa, not to teach us even about Haiti, which is next door to my country, because they didn't want another Haiti. They didn't want another revolution. So those are spaces we need to think about. How do we engage? How do we engage in the academic environment? How do we share books and then bring those into curriculum? How do we share spaces like this one that we're on right now? How do we encourage more diplomatic and cultural exchanges? In my country now, we'll have everybody coming through. We have Janet Jackson and wonderful artists who we love. They play nice music, and Lionel Richie and those. We love them, Black artists. But we don't get the African artists, right? That's just to say that Tyler would be very welcome. I took my brother, would be happy to have welcome to the and all of my little friends watching the water dance. So I'm just pulling a joke here, but that's what I mean. It's so far from our reality. Just to tell her that, well, she's South African, she's like, really? And so she's thinking she's American or something else, and nothing good is coming from Africa. So we have to really change that. We have to ensure that your artists come to us, that we hear you, and you have wonderful artists. Your writers, we must read about them. We must understand them. Your history, we must know them, and vice versa. You must know more than reggae. You must know Jonkanoo. In the Bahamas, we have something called Jonkanoo. It was very linked to our Ghanaian ancestors, right? And so the drums that we play in our music is very African. The food that we eat is very African. So those things, they went, and imagine 400 years later, I heard somebody share something for something sounding like Jonkanoo in Ghana. I was like, that's Jonkanoo. 400 years later, we play Jonkanoo in the Bahamas, and they were not able to take it out of our soul. They couldn't take the rhythm of the drums away from us. Right? So we have to think about where there are commonalities and build on them. Because it's just awesome, I think, to understand each other's culture and to work in those spaces where there is a lot of commonality.
I'm reflecting on this conversation that we've had, and I'm like, where would I ever have met Gaynal if it wasn't for a forum like this? Do you know what I mean? And so I'm already excited by this kind of prospect. And the other kind of newly forming one, there's an African Research Network for Transitional Justice that newly forming and that engaging with these issues across the continent and eventually growing from epistemologies from all over the world, and particularly places that have like a history of slavery and colonialism, and engaging with those attempts at justice and repair. So those are instances that I can think of, and especially again, I was speaking about the incorporation of like young people in it. I think we're seeing this real move towards how do we incorporate young people into this conversation without one being patronizing and two without taking away their agency as well. I think that there's an important link there. And I think that in this conversation, I view this as a very powerful conversation because I think that across oceans and across ages that we can engage in a conversation that is, we're talking about the same thing, just in different kind of contexts. And I think something like the Research Network for Transitional Justice is also something where a lot of young people are involved, but also it's a very collaborative space with older people from the UN, for instance, or whatever the case is. We're engaging in a very important conversation because that's also what keeps it going. And this idea of education, and I hadn't learned about the genocide against the Khoi and San people until I was in my first year of master's, and that I'm a South African person. And I think that's really telling of the spaces that don't exist within the education system and also outside of it. So I think that forums like this, if we can continue to be in conversation with each other and sharing those things, those understanding that we are all one, those understanding of what being means, I think is shared in these kinds of spaces. I'm excited about it.
On that note, thank you so much to both Dabano and Gaynal for joining me in conversation today. I am filled with lots of hope for all the partnerships that have come and all the partnerships that will come across the African diaspora. And I'm also filled with hope as we think further about preventing atrocity and structural inequalities. Thanks for listening to The Making of Atrocities: Is Racism a Risk Factor? A podcast from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. Our guests on this episode were Gaynal Curry and Lavano Ntuli. I've been your host, Parisha Naidu. The International Coalition of Sites of Conscience is a global network of over 350 historic sites, museums, and memory initiatives in more than 65 countries, all dedicated to using past struggles to address social injustice today. This show is brought to you by the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation, GIJTR for short. GIJTR is a flagship program led by the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience and consisting of 8 additional global organizations committed to promoting just and sustainable peace in conflict and post-conflict countries. It does this in a participatory, inclusive, and holistic manner, building the capacity of survivors and local civil society organizations to foster locally led initiatives that promote memory, truth, and justice.